protest. But a spokesperson for Just Stop Oi told Open Democracy that the group will continue protesting even if the legislation is passed. They said changes to protest law are irrelevant when set against the criminal actions of our current government. This will not stop future disruptive action taking place. The government should stop locking up ordinary people and take the no-brainer decision to end new oil and gas. Civil liberty groups also criticized the plan, saying that they would limit the right to peaceful protest. These rehashed measures to crack down on protest in today's Queen's speech are yet another power grab from a government determined to shut down accountability. Sam Grant, head of policy and campaign at Liberty, said, "Protest is a right, not a gift from the state, and measures like these are designed to stop ordinary people making their voices heard." Adding, Amnesty International UK CEO Sacha Deshmukh said the plans were repressive policies. He said it follows a pattern of a government voicing support for protests around the world, but cracking down on the right to speak up here at home. The public order bill will include new criminal offenses of locking on and being equipped to lock on to others, objects or buildings. These carry a maximum penalty of 6 months' imprisonment and an unlimited fine. It will also expand the stop and search powers to allow police to seize articles related to locking on. There will also be new offenses for interfering with key national infrastructure, such as airports, railways, or major transport works like HS2, which will also carry a maximum sentence of 12 months imprisonment and an unlimited fine. The bill will also introduce serious disruption prevention orders, banning individuals with previous protest-related offenses from attending further protests or from being involved in organizing them. Responding to the news, Nick Dearden, the director of Global Justice Now, said the real hooligans here are not protesters desperately trying to preserve life on this planet, but Boris Johnson's government, which is running riots over our hard-won democratic freedoms. The UK government first attempted to introduce the measures as amendments to its policing bill, after Home Secretary Priti Patel announced plans to criminalise protest tactics used by climate groups at the Conservative Party conference last October. But in January, the amendments were rejected by peers, who described them as menacing and dangerous. Despite government claims to the contrary, these are draconian laws that are part of a wider assault on our democracy, Baroness Jones of Mosocomb, a Green Party peer, said at the time.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Wa kun Allahumma bi'izzatika li fi kulli al-ahwali raufa wa alayya fi jami' al-umur atufa. Ilahi wa rabbi man li ghayrak as'aluhu kashf dhurri wan nazara fi amri.
Imam Ali alayhi salam says in this part of the Kumail supplication, wa kun Allahumma bi'izzatika li fi kulli al-ahwali raufa wa alayya fi jami' al-umuri atufa. And by your might, O Allah, be kind to me in all states, and be gracious to me in all my affairs. So after Imam Ali alayhi salam asks the Almighty Allah not to hasten him to punishment because of the evil doings he counted in the previous part, he now moves on as a supplicant and asks the Almighty Allah to be kind to him in all states. وَكُنِ اللَّهُمَّ بِعِزَّتِكَ لِي فِي كُلِّ الْأَحْوَالِ رَوْفَ. Be kind to me in all states by your might. No one in the world is able to describe Almighty Allah's kindness, even if that person is pretty knowledgeable. But his kindness can be understood from different signs, from pondering on Quranic verses, and also the traditions and the words of the Prophet's household, alayhimu salam. But I assume the simplest way for recognizing the mercy of Almighty Allah is by paying attention to the instances in which His mercy can be perceived. I mean, let me elaborate on this by having a look at a narration from the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He says, I asked and presented some requests before Allah. One of them was, O Allah, leave my nation's deeds to me to account for them. I was then addressed, even though you are the Prophet of kindness, but you are not the most merciful. If you are informed of some of the sins of your people, you would hate them. Let only me know about their sins. O Muhammad, I would account for them in such a way that no one would get informed of their sins, not even you. So when I hide their sins from you, you that are the manifestation of kindness, I would definitely hide their sins from others too. O Muhammad, if you have a prophethood of kindness to them, I have godly mercy to them. You are their prophet while I am their Lord. And if you are kind with them today, I've been kind to them from the very beginning and will be so till eternity.
Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you, and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence. O Allah, I beg you by your greatness to be compassionate to me in all circumstances, and be gracious to me in all affairs.
Thank you, Allah, that we hear, feel, and so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Brothers and sisters, this godly mercy of the Almighty Allah can be seen throughout our lifestyles, throughout our experiences. But the point is that it just needs insight. Even the biggest mercies of the Almighty Allah can be ignored if the person does not have insight. That is why Imam Ali alayhi salam said that the one who is overcome by forgetfulness, his heart dies. And if your heart dies, it will blind your insight. That is why we have been ordered throughout our traditions to do whatever we can to remind ourselves of the existence of the Almighty Allah and His mercy throughout our entire lives. Because forgetfulness of the Almighty Allah will blind your insight. And the one who is turned blind cannot recognize the existence of Almighty Allah's mercy and hereafter. So that is why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Kun Allahumma bi'izzatika li fi kulli al-ahwali raufa." And by your might, O Allah, be kind to me in all states. Wa alayya fi jami'i al-umuri atufa. Be gracious to me in all my affairs. You might remember when we were discussing the concept of supplication in the previous episodes, we discussed the reality of dua, and we mentioned that the reality of dua is being aware of the fact that there is one Almighty Allah you're talking to. He is your Lord and your Creator. And by supplication, you are actually talking to Him. You're getting yourself closer to Him. And this needs iqbal from you and Almighty Allah together. What I want to say is that the supplication itself, talking to the Almighty Allah, reminding yourself of the presence of the Almighty Allah, will avoid forgetfulness. And this is another benefit of supplication. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this, but I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. The painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's the same history, really. There's really, the United States had such a huge population of Native people, such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
On May 10, 2021, Israel began an offensive on the Gaza Strip that went on for 11 days. The regime razed several buildings in the meantime, including a tower housing the bureaus of several news outlets, including Al Jazeera's. The bombings killed over 250 Palestinians in the besieged enclave, including dozens of women and children. But this time, unlike other incidents where Israel launched attacks on the Strip, Palestinian resistance movements struck back hard, killing at least 12 Israelis.
We have to remember that while there have been deaths on both sides, the deaths of Palestinians far outnumber those of the Israelis, probably by close to 1,000 to 1. So there is not a lot of importance given to Palestinian lives. This has been an ongoing, longstanding policy of the world. It's completely unjust. It ignores international law and human rights, but this has been the case. But any efforts to bring rights to the Palestinians, rights that they are entitled to by international law simply because they live, because they exist, will be opposed because no other country wants to risk its economic ties with Israel.
The conflict had been in the making for several weeks prior when Israeli troops intensified their crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds during the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The protests that had erupted at the regime's attempt to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah also escalated the tensions. The devastating conflict ended in an Egypt-brokered ceasefire that went into effect on May 21st. The battle, however, significantly altered the perceptions about the military capabilities of Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The 2021 confrontation is widely hailed as a victory for Hamas and other resistance movements in Gaza, not only militarily and on the ground, but also morally on an international level. Demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood were held across the world. A wider and more diverse group of people around the globe called for an end to the conflict and Israel's aggression, which helped raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians to a much higher extent.
Israeli invisibility can mean a number of things. You're referring to militarily, but there's also the invincibility that it had for so many years as being seen as the victim, the innocent victim just trying to defend itself. That has certainly been shattered. People around the world, even if they support Israel, see Israel as the aggressor.
A year on, Tel Aviv is once again intensifying the pressure on the Palestinians. Israeli forces and settlers have repeatedly raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound over the past few weeks, a location that's considered Islam's third holiest site. In response, there has been a spike in the number of deadly Palestinian retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. Palestinians say the attacks are a natural response to Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa, an issue they warn is their red line. The mounting tensions between Palestinians and Israelis are raising fears about another confrontation. But the events over the past couple of years have indicated that Palestinians will continue to fight for what they believe in and that they can inflict pain on the other side, too.
Europe's largest economy, Germany, is going through a historic phase. Inflation rates have risen sharply, reaching a 40-year high, with soaring energy prices being the key driving force. According to the German Federal Statistics Agency, the Statist, consumer prices were about 7.5% higher in April compared to last year. Berlin also faces an imminent recession in case of a gas supply cut from Russia. The latest remarks by the chief executive officer of a major commercial bank in Germany have increased concerns inside the country. Manfred Knopf has warned that the energy supply in Germany is at risk, which may lead to the spread of bankruptcies in the country. Quoted by a German business newspaper, Knopf said the energy supply is at risk, supply chains are breaking, in addition to high inflation in the country. He also warned that bankruptcies in German markets are probably going to increase. According to the executive, almost a third of Germany's foreign trade has been impacted as well. Germany is facing soaring energy prices and a skyrocketing inflation due to the imposition of sanctions on Russia to pressure Moscow into ending the war in Ukraine. The measures mainly affected the financial sector and the supply of high-tech products. The real crisis in Germany lies in the Russian gas, on which it depends to a large extent. Berlin was one of the opponents within the EU to ban the import of Russian gas, but the scenario changed completely after it announced recently its readiness to accept an immediate ban on Russian oil and gas supplies. According to Forbes, Germany is one of the largest customers of Russian oil, and Berlin depends on a third of its Russian oil imports, 45% of its coal purchases, and 55% of its gas imports from Russia. Economists believe the immediate suspension of Russian energy imports would cause a severe recession in Germany.
The EU is not allowed to stop. This is what Washington ordered, and Washington orders the EU around. And the crazy situation right now is that Washington was never as powerful as it is today. This is especially funny since the American president is a weak president. So obviously somebody else is inserting this pressure into the EU from Washington, and I think that is the American deep state pushing Joe Biden and the EU, both of them. And as long as nobody stops this kind of power wielding, it will continue.
The Russia-Ukraine war is not comparable to any other war in history due to its geoeconomic significance. Both Ukraine and Russia are leading exporters of commodities such as crude, natural gas, iron and steel, wheat and edible oils that have a direct impact on inflation levels in major world economies. The conflict pushed crude prices to over $130 per barrel. There were also price increases on wheat, edible oils, and other commodities. The unilateral sanctions of the West against Russia had the unintended consequence of exacerbated inflation in Europe, East Africa, and South Asia, which were the largest importers of Russian wheat and energy. Despite the detrimental effect of sanctions on global markets, the EU unveiled plans for a Russian oil embargo earlier this week. The measure is expected to come into force within 9 months, with the time frame varying for different petroleum products. But several EU nations, including Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, are seeking an exemption from the ban.
And of course, all these sanctions against Russia are completely unfair, unjustified, and for the first time, because we have 8th of May today, and for the first time since the Second World War, a German government is again siding with Nazis and again against Russia. And this really makes Moscow very angry, and the people too.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's international friends bear responsibility for each Palestinian fatality in the context of the occupation, even when they purport to oppose the deadly violence. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Morphy, writer. This article is titled, Shirin Abu Aghila's Blood is on the Hands of Israeli Regime's Friends. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's international friends bear responsibility for each Palestinian fatality in the context of the occupation, even when they purport to oppose the deadly violence. European, North American, and UN officials condemned the killing of Al Jazeera reporter Shirin Abu Aghila while she was covering an Israeli military raid in Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Those supposed condemnations variably included vague calls for an investigation and accountability without specifically naming the fabricated regime of Israel as the party all but certainly responsible for Abu Oghle's death. Such calls for an investigation ring hollow when coming from parties that have failed to support the International Criminal Court's war crimes probe in Palestine. The UK, US, and Canada have actively tried to undermine that investigation, while the UN Secretary General's West Asia region envoys have refused to endorse it or any other international accountability measure against the fabricated regime of Israel. A preliminary investigation by Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, based on an autopsy result and eyewitness testimony, concluded that Abu Oghle was killed by a bullet fired by Israeli regime troops. Troops had surrounded a home in the camp on the pretext of searching for wanted persons, according to Al-Haq, and were met with armed resistance. Abu Oghle was hit in the head by a bullet fired by the direction of Israeli troops, who had full view of the Al Jazeera crew and not the resistance fighters, whose fire would not have been able to reach the journalist. Another journalist, Ali Samoudi, was shot in the back during the same incident and was reportedly in stable condition. Moreover, the type of projectile found in Abu Oghle's brain is a bullet issued to Israeli regime troops. Al-Haq said that Abu Oghle's killing may amount to premeditated murder. Immediately after her killing, and before any preliminary examination was possible, the Zionist regime launched a public relations campaign, distancing itself from responsibility for Abu Oghle's death. The Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz baselessly claimed that even though the military has yet to conclude its investigation, Israel is pushing the message that there are indications that Abu Oghle was not killed by Israelis. The ambiguity introduced by the Zionist regime's public relations blitz was enough to stick, however. The effort was a success, with news outlets privileging the Israeli regime line over the testimony of Abu Oghle's colleagues who survived the attack and said that they came under Israeli regime fire. An unnamed Israeli official told Haaretz that the spin campaign had already influenced leading news organizations, including the Associated Press, Sky News, the BBC, and AFP. The official said that these agencies, which initially reported that Abu Oghle had been killed by Israeli fire, were now reporting that the circumstances of her death are under investigation, Haaretz added. Yet, there will be no credible Israeli regime investigation into Abu Oghle's death, as the Zionist regime's self-investigation mechanism only exists to shield the regime and its personnel from international accountability. It is possible that a low-ranking Israeli troop will be slapped on the wrist, as happened in a handful of other cases concerning the death of a Palestinian at the hands of the Zionist regime's military. But there will be no true reckoning for the authors of the Zionist regime's open fire policy, which is exercised liberally against Palestinians living under its military rule, guaranteeing that the bloodshed will continue. Calls for an investigation by parties in a position to put actual pressure on the Zionist regime are all the more insulting given that less than a week ago, the Zionist regime's highest court approved the forced expulsion of Palestinians living in the Masafer Yatta area of the southern West Bank. With the stroke of a pen, a trio of Israeli judges, one of them a settler from the UK who lives in a West Bank colony, signed off on the violent displacement of more than 1,000 Palestinians from the land where they've lived for generations. In other words, they approved a war crime. These two, the European Union condemned as they condemned the killing of Abu Aqile. It is rare for the EU, which usually only expresses its concern, to condemn any violation of Palestinian rights, let alone twice in a week. But without imposing any actual consequences on the fabricated regime of Israel, such condemnation is an empty gesture. EU condemnation hasn't stopped the Zionist regime from carrying out the forced expulsion of Masafer Yatta, where it demolished Palestinian homes and other property, displacing Palestinian residents. Such condemnation is a mere performance intended to give the appearance of objection but taking meaningful action. Shirin Abu Aqile was a U.S. citizen, as was Omar Asad, an older Palestinian man who was left to die on the ground after having a heart attack while being arbitrarily detained by Israeli troops who raided his West Bank village earlier this year. The fabricated regime of Israel initially lied about the circumstances of his death, claiming that he had resisted a check by the Israeli troops and was released alive. The U.S. pressed the Zionist regime for an investigation but didn't put any conditions on military aid, meaning that the Zionist regime had nothing to lose by failing to meaningfully investigate Assad's death. Any condemnation that doesn't come with consequences is actually a permission slip for the fabricated regime of Israel to continue to kill Palestinians, destroy their communities, and deny their freedom. It is a green light to the Zionist regime to keep murdering Palestinians with full impunity. Yet most deaths of Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist regime's military don't receive any condemnation from the regime's powerful friends, however hollow that condemnation may be. There were no condemnations from Brussels or Washington over the killing of 16-year-old Tahir Maslat in the West Bank, the 10th Palestinian child fatality at the hands of the fabricated regime of Israel so far this year. The Zionist regime claimed that the troops fired rubber-coated bullets at Palestinians who threw stones at troops who had raided Al-Bira, the town near Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority. That claim will be good enough for the diplomats and foreign press corps, who are all too happy to take the Zionist regime at its word, as worthless as it may be, and have allowed the fabricated regime of Israel, apartheid, and colonization to go on year after year, decade after decade. Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through straight buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Canada. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Kololangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. While some drivers are obsessed with the speed, some others have a passion for the look of their cars. In Tehran, car tuning lovers have assembled for the biggest show of modified vehicles. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
Fast and furious. It's the biggest show of personal cars turned SUVs. Held in Tehran's Island Karting Track, the event brought together more than 500 motorists to flaunt their modified cars.
This is the only place where car tuning lovers can vent their energy and show off their beautiful cars. When I saw the call for such a big assembly of modified vehicles, I didn't waste a moment and decided to bring my car here.
Exhausts sound deeper, with flames popping out. Sound systems rattle the car roofs. And regular doors are replaced by butterfly doors, opening upward. To these people, car tuning is more than a hobby, but a passion.
Majid says he has spent double the price of this Peugeot 206 to turn it into a green beast.
For us, our cars mean everything. To me, it's love. I save whatever I earn to spend on my car. So I urge the police to respect this love and stop fining us when we roll with our cars on the streets.
Based on Iran's traffic regulations, drivers are not allowed to alter the original design of their cars. Installing loudspeakers and noisy exhaust systems, and even attaching stickers, are associated with fines. Omid says he can't take this. He has transformed his Iranian-made car, dubbed Rana, into a whole new model, saying it looks better now on the street.
I spent whatever I could afford to make the streets look better with our cars, but the police are treating us like we are wrongdoers. I myself oppose dangerous driving in the city. What I want is just to make my car look more attractive.
Car tuning encompasses any modification to a vehicle that would lead to a higher engine performance and dynamic handling of the car. As long as these people stick to these rules, police will not have issues. Otherwise, they must keep these beauties inside their parking lots.
Thank you. However eye-catching they are, these mutated cars are no longer road pets and are good for drifting on tracks like this. Organizers say that's exactly why they held this show, to provide a chance for cartooning maniacs to vent their energy in a safe place. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The third long-duration team of astronauts launched by SpaceX to the International Space Station, ISS, for NASA safely departed the orbiting outpost to begin their descent back to Earth, capping a six-month science mission. Live video showing the capsule drifting away from the station as the two vehicles soared high over Australia was shown on a NASA webcast. Wearing helmeted white and black spacesuits, the four astronauts were seen strapped into the crew cabin shortly before the spacecraft separated from the station, orbiting some 400 kilometers above the Earth. NASA said one of the cosmonauts, Oleg Artemyev, assumed command of the ISS from Marshburn in a handover before Thursday's undocking.
And I relinquish control of the or command of the space station to you.
I accept command. I accept command. Thank you for here. Thank you for friendship. It was unbelievable time to get.
If all goes smoothly, the crew Dragon craft dubbed Endurance will parachute into the sea off the coast of Florida on Friday. Their departure came about a week after they welcomed their replacement team aboard the station, also currently home to three Russian cosmonauts on a long-term mission.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.